most any of the women he'd bedded. Still, waking up and seeing her the first thing in the morning was more than he wanted to think about ever again.
"Logan's your friend," she said. "He'll understand."
"He's a great friend," the prince said. "But he sees things in black and white. Do you know how uncomfortable he was with me leaving him downstairs while I came upstairs with my father's mistress? I need you to get the gem, now." Sometimes he could just thank the gods that Logan was a known prig.
"Fine," she said peevishly. "Where is it? Your husband could come in any second."
"My husband just came home today."
"So?"
"So whatever else he is, the pig's faithful. So he's practically burning with passion whenever he gets back from a diplomatic assignment. He's recuperating downstairs. The poor dear, I think I exhausted him."
She laughed, and it was a harsh, callous sound.
"I kept imagining it was you."
With what she must have imagined was a seductive look, she shrugged her shoulders, and the front of her dress fell open. She rubbed against his body and tugged at the laces of his breeches again.
"Trudana, please. Please keep that on. Where is it?"
He didn't even look at her body, and he could tell it infuriated her.
"As I was saying," she said finally, "I knew you'd be here tonight, so I gave the globe to my maid. She's just two doors down. Are you satisfied?"
She hitched up her dress and walked to her dresser. She looked at herself in the mirror.
The prince turned without saying anything. He'd thought this was going to be easy, that he was going to make his father owe him a huge favor for doing practically nothing. Now he saw that Trudana Jadwin was going to be a lifelong enemy.
"Never again," he promised himself. "I will never sleep with a married woman again."
He didn't even pay attention to the sound of a drawer sliding open. He didn't even want to look at Trudana. He wasn't even going to stay long enough to lace up his breeches. 1 second more was 1 second too many. His hand was on the latch when he heard the rapid shuffle of her feet. Then something hot lanced into his back. It felt like a wasp sting. Then Trudana's body crushed into him, and he felt the stinger sink deeper. His head smacked against the door in front of him, and he felt the sting again. It wasn't a sting. It was too deep. He gasped as roaring filled his ears. There was something wrong with one of his lungs. He wasn't breathing right. The stabbing continued, and the roaring receded. The world took on a startling clarity. He was being stabbed to death by a woman. It was embarrassing, really. He was the prince. He was one of the top swordsmen in the realm, and this fat-assed old woman with saggy, uneven breasts was killing him. She was breathing, practically gasping in his ear, the same way that she had when they made love. And she was speaking, crying as if every stab were somehow hurting her. The self-pitying bitch.
"I'm sorry. Oh, oh, I'm sorry. You don't know what he's like. I have to. I have to. I have to."
The stabbing continued, and it irritated him. He was already dying, his lungs filling with blood. Coughing, he tried to clear them, which succeeded in spraying blood on the door. But his lungs were mincemeat, and blood just rushed back into the gaps. He slumped, hit his knees in front of the door, and she finally stopped. His vision was going dark, and his face slumped forward into the door. The last thing he saw through the keyhole was an eye on the opposite side of the keyhole, emotionlessly watching him die. He found the door with no problem. It was locked, but he picked it in seconds.
"Let her be asleep. Please."
Easing open the door of the cramped room, Kylar found himself staring at an oversized meat cleaver. It was being held by Aline. She was very much awake. In the darkness, Eline obviously didn't recognize him. She looked torn between screaming and hacking at him, her eyes locked on the sword in his hand. She decided to do both. Slapping her hand with the flat of his bollock dagger, Kylar launched the knife out of her grip. He dodged a grasping hand and got behind her in a moment, clapping a hand over her mouth. "It's me, it's me," he said, as he had to twist this way and that to dodge flying elbows. He couldn't hold a hand over her mouth and pin both arms and stop the kicks she was aiming at his groin. "Be quiet, or your mistress dies." As she seemed to regain her sanity, Kylar finally let Eline go. "I knew it," she said, furiously but quietly. "I knew I couldn't trust you. I knew it was just going to be you. I meant your mistress will die because your noise will bring the wet boy here." Silence. Then, "Oh, yes." In the dim moonlit room, he couldn't be sure, but Kylar thought he saw her blushing. "You could have knocked," she said.
"Sorry. Old habit."
Suddenly awkward, she picked up the cleaver off the bed and put it under her pillow. Looking down at her nightgown, which was disappointingly chaste, she seemed embarrassed. She grabbed a robe and turned her back while she put it on.
"Relax," Kylar said as she turned back to face him. "It's a little late for modesty. I saw your statue. You look good naked."
Why had he twisted that last bit to make her sound like a whore? Even if she was sleeping with the Duke, what choice did she have? She was a servant in the man's house. It wasn't fair. But Kylar still felt betrayed. Eline folded, as if he'd hit her in the stomach. "I begged her not to display it," Eline said. "But she was so proud of it. She said I should be proud, too."
"She?"
"The Duchess," Eline said.
"The Duchess?"
Kylar repeated stupidly.
"Not the Duke." "Not the Duke?"
He felt at once vastly relieved and more confused than ever. Why should he feel relieved? "Do you think I'd model naked for the Duke?" she asked. "What do you think, that I'm his mistress?" Her eyes widened as she saw the expression on his face. "Well..." Kylar felt like he'd unjustly accused her, then felt mad that she was making him feel embarrassed for drawing a perfectly good conclusion, then felt mad that he was wasting time talking to a girl when a wet boy was probably waiting out in the hall. This is madness.
"It happens," he said, defensively.
"Why am I doing this?"
"For the same reason I've watched her from afar. Because I'm intoxicated by her."
"Not with me."
"You mean you're a..."
He was trying to sound snide, but he trailed off. Why was he trying to sound snide? "A virgin, yes," she said, unembarrassed. "Are you?" Kylar clenched his jaw.
"I... look, there's a killer here."
Eline seemed about to comment about Kylar avoiding her question. Then her look darkened as the joy leached out of it.
"Two," she said quietly.
"What?"
"Two killers." She meant him. Kylar nodded, again, feeling a lump in his throat. And suddenly, he was ashamed of what he was.
"Yes. Two."
"I saw Hugh coming in, Eline. Is the globe safe?"
He was watching her eyes. As expected, they darted to where she'd hidden it, the bottom of her closet.
"Yes," she said. "It's..."
Her voice died.
"You're going to steal it."
"I'm sorry," Kylar said. "And now you know where I hid it. You set me up." She was naive, but she wasn't stupid. Yes. Anger built in her brown eyes. Is there even an assassin? Or was it all a lie? There is one, I give you my word, Kylar said, looking away. For all that's worth. Ouch. I am sorry, Aline, but I have to.
Why?
It's hard to explain, he said. I spent all day being embarrassed about everything I'd ever written to you. I spent all day feeling terrible how much you'd given for me. I didn't even tell the guards you were coming because I thought...
You're a real piece of work, Kylar, she said.
I guess Azoth really did die.
Not like this. Not like this.
I really do have to take it, he said.
I can't let you do that, she said.
Aline, if you stay here, they'll think you helped me. If Hugh doesn't kill you, the Jadwins might. They could throw you in the maw, Aline.
Come with me. I couldn't live with myself if they did that.
You'll manage. Just take a new name, throw money at whatever makes you feel guilty.
They'll kill you.
I won't repay good with evil. He was running out of time. He had to get out of here. Kylar exhaled. So everything was going to go the worst possible way tonight.
Then I'm sorry for this, he said. But it's to save you.
What is?
She asked. Kylar punched her. Twice. Once in the mouth, hard enough to draw blood, and once in her beautiful, piercing eyes, hard enough that they would blacken and swell shut, so they wouldn't see what he did. As she staggered backward, he spun her around and clamped her in a chokehold. She flailed vainly against his grip, doubtless thinking he was killing her. But he merely held her and jabbed a needle in her neck. In seconds, she was unconscious.
She'll never forgive me for this. I'll never forgive me for this.
Kylar laid her on the floor and pulled out a knife. He cut his hand and dripped blood onto Aline's face to make it look like she'd been beaten. It was gross, and the contrast of her beauty with the ugliness of what he was doing made him uncharacteristically squeamish. But it had to be done. She had to look like a victim. Looking at her there, unconscious, was like eating his own little slice of the bitter business. The bitterness of the business was the truth of the business. Even here, when he hadn't killed her, when he didn't have to bathe in the all-permeating odors of death, Kylar had closed the eyes that saw the truth of him, blackened the eyes of light that illuminated the darkness in him, had bloodied and blinded the eyes that pierced him. Who says there are no poets in the bitter business? Finished, Kylar arranged Aline's limbs in a suitably graceless pattern. The silver kakari was tucked in a slipper in the bottom of the closet. Kylar held it up to examine it in the moonlight. It was a plain, metallic sphere, utterly featureless. In truth, it was a little disappointing. Despite the metallic sheen, it was translucent, which was novel. Kylar had never seen anything like that, but he'd been hoping the kakari would do something spectacular. He tucked the ball into a pouch and moved to the door. So far, so good. Well, actually, so far, tonight had been pretty much an unmitigated disaster. Getting out should be relatively easy. If he couldn't sneak past the guard at the bottom of the servant's stairs, he could walk right up to the man and pretend that he'd been looking for the toilet and had needed to go so badly that he'd gone for the first available one. The guard would give him a warning that the upstairs was off limits. Kylar would say they should have guards at the bottom of the stairs if they didn't want anyone to go up them. The guard would be chagrined, and Kylar would go home. Not foolproof, but then, tonight, Kylar would have distrusted anything that was foolproof. Looking through the keyhole, He watched the hallway and listened closely for 30 seconds. There was nothing out there. The moment he cracked the door, someone kicked the other side with more than mortal strength. The door blew into him, hitting his face first, then his shoulder. It launched him back into the room. He almost kept his feet, but as he flew back, he tripped over Eileen's unconscious body and went down hard. He slid across the stone floor until his head collided with the wall. Barely holding onto consciousness, black spots exploding in front of his eyes, Kylar must have drawn the pair of daggers on pure instinct, because his hands protested in pain as the daggers were knocked out of them.
Boy!
Kylar had to blink several times before he could see again. When his vision cleared, the first thing he saw was the knife point, an inch from his eye. He followed that up the gray-clad arm and hooded body. Woozy, Kylar wondered why he wasn't dead. But even before Hugh pulled back his hood, Kylar knew. Mama Kay had betrayed them. She'd sent him to kill the wrong man.
Master Blint?
He asked. Chapter 41.
What are you doing?
Master Blint backhanded Kylar soundly. He stood, furious, the illusory features of Hugh Gibbet melting away like smoke. Kylar staggered to his feet, his head still spinning and his ears ringing.
I had to. You were gone.
Gone planning this?
Blint whispered hoarsely.
Gone planning this? Never mind now. We've got 3 minutes until the guard's next round.
He nudged Eileen's limp form with a toe.
That one's still alive,
Durzo Blint said.
Kill her. Then go find the Kakari while I fix the deader. We'll discuss your punishment later.
I'm too late.
You killed the Duchess? Kylar asked, rubbing his shoulder where the door had hit him when Durzo burst in.
The deader was the prince. Someone else got there first.
Boots were clumping up the steps. Durzo unsheathed retribution and checked the hallway.
Gods! The prince?
Kylar looked at the unconscious girl. Her innocence was irrelevant. Even if he didn't kill her, they'd think she helped steal the Kakari and kill the prince.
Kylar!
Kylar looked up, dazed. It was all like a bad dream. It couldn't be happening.
I already...
He held out the pouch, limply. Scowling, Durzo snatched it away from him and turned it over. The globe of edges fell into his hand.
Damn! Just what I thought,
he said.
What?
Kylar asked. But Durzo wasn't in any mood to answer questions.
Did the girl see your face?
Kylar's silence was enough.
Take care of it. Kylar, that's not a request. It's an order. Kill her.
Thick, white scars crisscrossed what had once been a beautiful face. Her eyes were swelling, blackening. And that was as much Kylar's fault as the 10-year-old scars were.
Love is a noose,
Blint had told him when he began his apprenticeship a decade ago.
No,
Kylar said. Durzo looked back.
What did you say?
Black blood dribbled down retribution, pooling on the floor. There was still time to stop, time to obey and live. But if he let Eileen die, Kylar would be lost in shadow forever.
I won't kill her.
And I won't let you.
I'm sorry, Master.
Do you have any idea what that means?
Durzo snapped.
Who is this girl that she's worth being hunted for the rest of your short...
He stopped.
She's Doll Girl.
Yes, Master.
I'm sorry. By the night angels, I don't want apologies, I want obedient—
Durzo held up a finger for silence. The footfalls were close now. Durzo threw open the door and blurred into the hall, inhumanly fast. Retribution flashing silver in the low light. The guard fell in two thumps. It was Stumpy, the older guard who'd frisked Kylar so gingerly when he'd cased the estate this morning. The hall lantern behind Durzo swaddled darkness's favorite child in shadow, casting his form over Kylar and making his face invisible. Silhouetted, black blood dripped from the tip of Retribution. Drip. Drip. Durzo's voice strained like bending steel.
Kylar, this is your last chance.
Yes, Kylar said, his bollock dagger hissing against its scabbard as he turned to face the man who'd raised him, who'd been more than a father to him. It is. There was the sound of something metallic rolling across marble. It came toward Kylar. He raised a hand and felt the kakari slap into his outstretched palm. He turned his hand over and saw the kakari burning a brilliant incandescent blue. It was stuck to his palm. As he looked, runes began burning on the surface of globe. They shifted, changed, as if trying to speak to him. Blue light bathed his face, and he could see through the kakari. It was sucking blood from the cut on his palm. He looked up and saw dismay on Master Blint's face.
No, no, it's mine!
Blint yelled. The kakari pooled like black oil in an instant. Blue light exploded like a supernova. Then the pain came. The cold in Kylar's hand became pressure. It felt like his hand was splitting apart. Staring at the now uniformly burning puddle in his hand with horror, Kylar saw that it was shrinking. It was pushing itself into his hand. Kylar felt the kakari enter his blood. Every vein bulged and contorted, freezing as the kakari passed through him. He didn't know how long it lasted. He sweated and shivered and sweated coldly. Gradually, the cold faded from his limbs. More gradually still, warmth replaced it. Perhaps seconds, perhaps half an hour later, Kylar found himself on the floor. Oddly, he felt good. Even face down on stone, he felt good. Complete. Like a gap had been bridged, a hole had been filled. I'm a kakarifer. I was born for this. Then he remembered. He looked up. From the look of frozen horror on Durzo's face, it must have taken only seconds. Kylar jumped to his feet, feeling stronger, healthier, more full of energy than he could ever remember. The look on Durzo's face wasn't anger. It was grief. Bereavement. Kylar slowly turned his hand over. The skin was still cut on his palm, but it wasn't bleeding anymore. The kakari had seemed to push into... No. It couldn't have. From every pore in his hand, black poured out like sweat. It congealed. In a moment, the kakari rested in his palm. Strange glee filled Kylar. Fear followed. He wasn't sure the glee was all his own. It was as if the kakari were happy to have found him. He looked back to Durzo, feeling stupid, so far out of his depth he didn't know how to act. It was then he realized how clearly he could see Durzo's face. The man still stood in the hallway, the lantern behind him. A moment before the kakari, his face had been all but invisible. Kylar could still see the shadows falling on the floor where Durzo blocked the light. but he could see through them. It was like looking through glass. You could tell the glass was there, but it didn't impede your vision. Kylar glanced around Eline's little room and saw that the same applied to everything he looked at. The darkness welcomed his eyes now. His eyes were sharper, clearer. He could see further, could see the castle across the river as if it were high noon.
"I have to have the Kakari," Durzo said. "If he doesn't get it, he'll kill my daughter. Night angels, have mercy, Kylar, what have you done?"
I didn't do anything," Kylar said. He held the Kakari out. "Take it. You can have it. Get your daughter back."
Durzo took it from him. He stared into Kylar's eyes, his voice sorrowful.
"You bonded it. It bonds for life, Kylar. Your talent will work now, whether you're holding it or not. But its other powers won't work for anyone else until you're dead."
There was the sound of feet running up the steps. Someone must have heard Durzo's yell. Kylar had to go now. The import of Durzo's words was barely beginning to register. Durzo turned to face whoever was coming up the steps, and the prophet's words echoed in Kylar's ears.
"If you don't kill Durzo Blint tomorrow, Kalador will take Cenaria. If you don't kill him by the day after that, everyone you love will die. If you do the right thing once, it will cost you years of guilt. If you do the right thing twice, it will cost you your life."
The Bollock dagger was in his hand. Durzo's back was turned. Kylar could end it now. Not even Durzo's reflexes could stop him when Kylar was this close. It would mean stopping an invasion, saving everyone he loved. Surely that meant he held Eline's life in his hands right now. Logan's. Maybe the Drake's. Maybe the whole invasion hinged on this. Maybe hundreds or thousands of lives were balanced now on the point of his dagger. A quick, painless cut, and Durzo would die. Hadn't he said that life was empty, worthless, meaningless, cheap? He wouldn't be losing anything of value when he lost his life. He'd sworn that. Durzo had said it. And more. But Kylar had never really believed him. Mama Kay had already stabbed Durzo in the back with her lies. Kylar couldn't do it with his hands. The moment took on a startling clarity. It froze like a diamond and rotated before his eyes, every facet gleaming, futures shearing off and sparkling. Kylar looked from Eline on his right hand to Durzo on his left, from Durzo to Eline, Eline to Durzo. There was his choice and their futures. He could kill Eline, the woman he loved, or he could kill Durzo, who had raised him as his son. In every facet, the truth glared pitilessly. If one lived, the other must die.
"No," Kylar said. "Master, do it. Kill me."
Durzo looked at him as if he couldn't believe his ears.
"She's only seen me. She won't be a threat to anyone if I'm dead. You can take the Kakari and save your daughter."
Blint's eyes filled with a look Kylar had never seen before. The hard, jagged cast of his master's face seemed to ease, and it made him seem a different man, not old and tired and worn, but younger, a man more like Kylar than Kylar had ever imagined Blint could look. Durzo blinked as bottomless wells of grief threatened to spill over in tears. He shook his head.
"Just go, son."
Kylar wanted to go. He wanted to run away. But he was right. It was the only way. He stood there, frozen, but not with indecision.
He was just praying that Durzo would act before he lost his courage. What am I saying? I don't want to die. I want to live. I want to take Aline out of here. I want to... The door to the Duke's chambers opened, and the blood-spattered Duchess stumbled out, screaming, "Assassin! Assassin! He's killed the prince!" Durzo acted instantly. He slammed into Kylar, driving them both into Aline's room. It took all of Kylar's presence of mind not to trample Aline, but Durzo was still moving. He had a hold of Kylar's cloak and was swinging him with the surprising speed and force of his talent. Kylar exploded through the window and out into the night. By the grace of the god, or his cruelty, or sheer dumb luck, or Durzo's preternatural skills, Kylar landed squarely in the center of a hedge. He crashed through it, rolling out of control, and popped out onto the ground. It was ridiculous. Nothing was broken. Nothing was sprained. He didn't even get scratched. He looked up and saw guests craning their heads on the balcony where so recently he'd kissed Sierra, but they were on the other side of lamps and couldn't make him out. Then, the screaming from inside was taken up by others, women's voices and men's. Orders were being shouted, and armed men were running, clanking and ringing in their chain mail. Kylar looked up at the second story with his heart in his throat. He didn't know whether to curse or laugh. The decision was out of his hands for now. He was alive, and it felt good. There was nothing else to do. Kylar jogged to the estate's garden gate, broke the lock, and disappeared into the night. Chapter 42. The God-King Gareth Orsul was awake before the functionary knocked on his bedchamber door. No one could approach this room without waking him. It meant less sleep than he might like, but he was an old man now. He didn't need much sleep. Besides, it kept the slaves on their toes. The room wasn't what one might expect of a God-King. It was open, light, and airy, filled with beautiful plangon-stained glass, and ivory mirrors, and sethi lace on the bed, and dire bear rugs from the frieze on the floors, and freshly cut flowers on the desk and the mantel, all chosen and arranged by a slave with aesthetic sensibilities. Gareth cared for none of it but the paintings. Portraits of his wives lined the walls. His wives had come from almost every nation in Midcryu, and with few exceptions, all were beautiful. Petite or willowy, buxom or boyish, pale or dark, the images all pleased Gareth Orsul. He was a connoisseur of feminine beauty, and he spared no expense in indulging his vice. It was, after all, a service to his family and the world that he breed the best sons possible. That was where the unattractive women came in. He'd experimented with kidnapping women from royal families in hope that they might produce more acceptable sons. Two of his current 9 ethlings had been born of such women, so Gareth supposed that nobles might produce acceptable sons at a slightly better rate than the rabble. But it was ever so much more tedious to breed with an ugly woman. Partly for his son's sake, and partly for his own amusement, he'd even indulged in making some of the women love him. It had been surprisingly easy. He hadn't had to lie as much as he'd expected. Women were so willing to do that to themselves. He'd heard that love made the sex better. But he wasn't impressed. With magic, he could make a woman's body respond to him however he pleased. And there was a joy in watching a woman try to hold her fury and hatred while his magic pleased her in ways she'd never felt before. Unfortunately, such pleasures did have their price. Those wives had to be watched closely. He'd lost 2 to suicide. The functionary's hand banged on the door and Gareth gestured it open. The functionary came in on his knees, scooting forward, crossing his arms on his chest.
"My God, my majestic king."
Gareth sat up.
"Out with it. You have a message from the Jadwin slut?"
"She reports that she has killed the prince, but has lost possession of the Kakari. So sorry, your holiness."
"Doubtless it's another counterfeit,"
Gareth said, addressing himself, not the functionary.
"Have the ships arrived for the Modaini invasion?"
Scenaria he could deal with whenever he pleased, but a straight march south would tie up his armies for weeks or months. That damned Duke Gyre had turned the defenses at Screaming Winds into a serious obstacle. He could take it, of course. He could probably defeat any army in the world now, except the Alatyrans. But a god-king didn't waste men or meisters on frontal assaults. Not when he had other options. Besides, what conqueror would really want a hive like Scenaria anyway? He'd almost do better to exterminate everyone there and send his own subjects to colonize the city. Gareth Orsul's interest wasn't in temporal power. The bid for Scenario was just an amusement. He had far more reliable intelligence that the Red Kakari was in Modai. Once there, he would have Scenario surrounded. He could probably take the country without even fighting for it. Then Siura, and a strike right into the mage's heart. Shosendi. He wouldn't have to face Alatira until he was sure of victory.
"Two ships are still passing through Scenarian waters."
"Good. Then..."
"Your Holiness,"
the man squeaked as he realized whom he had just interrupted.
"Hopper?"
"Yes, Your Holiness."
Hopper's voice was barely a whisper.
"Don't ever interrupt me again."
Hopper nodded wide-eyed.
"Now what did you have to say?"
"Lady Jadwin claims to have seen someone bond the Kakari in the hallway outside her room. Her description was accurate."
"By Kali's blood,"
Gareth breathed. "A Kakari, after all this time. A Kakari someone had bonded. That almost made it easier. A Kakari alone was small enough, it could be hidden or lost anywhere. But a Kakari that was bonded would be kept close by whomever bonded it.
Reroute those ships, and order Roth to go ahead with the assassinations. The Gyres, the Shinga, all of them. Tell Roth he's got 24 hours.
Something was terribly wrong. Regnus Gyre knew that as soon as he reached the gates of his home. No guards were standing outside. Even with how many of his servants and guards the king had managed to have fired or driven off in the last decade, that was disturbing. The lamps were still burning inside the manse, which was odd. An hour past midnight.
"Should I call out, my lord?"
Gurdon Frey, his guard, asked.
"No."
Regnus dismounted and looked through his saddlebags until he found the key. He opened the gate and drew his sword. On either side of the gate, out of the lamplight, was a body. Each had his throat cut.
"No,"
Regnus said. "No." He started running for the manse. He burst through the front door and saw red everywhere. At first his mind refused to accept it. In every room, he found the dead. All looked like they had been caught unawares. Nothing was broken. There were no signs of violent conflict at all, except the bodies. Not even the guards had fought. Almost everyone had had his throat slashed. Then the bodies had been turned, so they would bleed as much as possible. Here, old Dunnell was seated upside down in a chair. There, Marianne, who had been Logan's wet nurse, was laid down the stairs with her head on the bottom step. It was as if Death himself had strolled through the house, and no one had even tried to stop him. Everywhere, Regnus saw trusted servants, friends, dead. He found himself running up the stairs, past the statue of the Grask twins, toward Katrina's room. In the hall, he saw the first signs of a struggle. An errant sword had smashed a display case. A portrait of his grandfather had a chunk of frame missing. The guards here had died fighting the killing wounds on their chests or faces. But the winner was clear, because each body had had its throat cut and its legs propped up on the walls. The puddles from a dozen men met, coating the floor as if it were a lake of blood. Gurdon knelt, his fingers touching a friend's neck.
"They're still warm," he said.
Regnus kicked open the door of his room. It banged noisily, if it had been closed and locked earlier in the night. It wasn't now. 4 men and 2 women were there, stripped, lying face down in an open circle. Above them, naked, hanging upside down from 1 foot tied to the chandelier high above, while the other leg flopped grotesquely, was Katrina. Cut into the backs of the corpses, 1 word to each, were the words, "Love and Kisses, Hugh Gibbet." The knife standing straight out of the steward Wendell North's back served as the period. Regnus ran. He ran from room to room, checking the dead, calling out their names, turning them over to look at their faces. He became dimly aware of Gurdon shaking him.
"Sir, sir, he's not here. Logan's not here. We have to leave. Come with me."
He let Gurdon drag him outside, and the smell of air without blood in it was sweet. Someone was repeating over and over, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." It was him. He was babbling. Gurdon paid no attention to him, just pulled him along, stumbling. They got to the front door just as 6 of the king's elite lancers rode up to it with lances leveled.
"Hold!"
the lieutenant called. His men fanned out around Regnus and Gurdon.
"Hold! Are you Regnus Gyre?"
Something about the bared steel and the sound of his own name weakened him.
"Yes," he said,
looking at his bloody clothes. Then stronger.
"Yes, I am he."
"Lord Gyre, I've been ordered to arrest you. I'm sorry, sir."
He was young, this lieutenant. His eyes were wide, as if he couldn't believe whom he was arresting.
"Arrest me?"
His mind was slowly coming back under his power, like a horse that had taken the bit in its teeth and galloped its own way, and was now willing to submit once more.
"Yes, my lord, for the murder of Katrina Gyre."
A wave of cold washed through Regnus. He could brace, or he could break. He clenched his jaw, and the tears that sprang from his eyes seemed oddly out of place with the command in his voice.
"When did you get your orders, son?"
"An hour ago, sir," the lieutenant said, then looked peeved that he'd so automatically obeyed a man he was supposed to be arresting.
"She hasn't been dead 15 minutes. So tell me, what does that say about your orders?"
The lieutenant's face blanched. A moment later, the lances were wavering.
"Our captain said you'd been seen killing..."
"Doing it, sir. An hour ago he said that." The lieutenant looked at Gurdon. "Is it true?"
"Go see for yourself," Gurdon said.
The lieutenant went inside, leaving the men nervously guarding them. Some of the men peeked through the windows and quickly looked away. Regnus felt impatient, as though, if he were given time, he might think again. Might detach from his mind. Tears were running down his cheeks again, and he didn't know why. He had to think. He could find out the captain's name, but the man was also just obeying orders, whether from the Sakage or the king. Several minutes later, the lieutenant emerged. He had vomit in his beard and was shaking violently.
"You may go, Lord Gyre.
And I'm sorry."
"Let him go."
The men withdrew, and Regnus mounted. But he didn't leave.
"Will you serve the man who massacred my whole family?"
Regnus asked.
"I intend to find my son. And I intend to find who..."
His voice betrayed him, and he had to clear his throat.
"Come with me, and I swear you will serve with honor."
His voice cracked on the last word, and he knew he could say no more. The lieutenant nodded.
"We're with you, sir."
The men nodded, and Regnus had his first squad.
"My lord,"
the lieutenant said,
I cut her down, sir.
I couldn't leave her like that."
Regnus couldn't speak. He sawed at his reins viciously and galloped for the gates.
"Why didn't I do that?
She was my wife.
What kind of man am I?"
Lord General Aegon was one of the few nobles who hadn't been at the Jadwin's party last night. He hadn't been invited. Not that he felt left out. The sun was just creeping over the horizon, and the situation didn't look any better in the light of day. Usually, of course, the city guard would handle a murder, but usually the victims of murder weren't heirs to the throne. Aegon needed to oversee this one personally.
"Why don't you tell me what really happened, milady?"
Aegon said. No matter what he did here, he was going to be the loser. Lady Jadwin sniffled. She was genuinely distraught. Aegon was sure of that. What he wasn't sure of was whether it was because she had been caught, or because she was sorry the prince was dead.
"I have told you," she said. "A wet boy..."
"A what?"
She stopped.
"How do you know what a wet boy is, Trudana?"
She shook her head.
"Why are you trying to confuse me? I'm telling you an assassin was here, standing in this hallway. Do you think I beheaded my own guard? Do you think I'm strong enough for that? Why won't you listen to Eileen? She'll tell you."
Blast. He had thought about that. Not only did he doubt that Lady Jadwin was strong enough to behead a man, but she had no weapon to do it with. And if she'd just murdered the prince without saying a word, why would she cry out and draw people upstairs before she had a chance to clean the blood off her hands and face? "Explain this," he said. He lifted the red dress she'd worn the night before. His men had discovered it, wadded up in the closet. It was still damp with hardening blood. A lot of blood.
After the assassin stabbed the prince, he fell and I caught him, and he died in my arms. I tried to get help, but the assassin was still in the hall. I was terrified. I panicked. I couldn't stand to have his blood all over me."
"What were the two of you doing alone in the bedchamber?"
The Duchess stared at him, as if her eyes were hot coals.
"How dare you?"
"How dare you, Trudana?" Aegon said.
"How dare you cheat on your husband, not just with the king, but also with the king's son? What kind of perverse pleasure did you take out of that? Did you like making the prince betray his father?"
She tried to slap him, but he moved.
"You can't slap everyone in the kingdom, Trudana. We found the bloody knife in your room. Your servants vouched that it's yours. I'd say the odds are that you're going to be beheaded, unless, that is, the king decides you deserve a common traitor's death on the wheel."
At those words, Trudana Jadwin paled and turned green, but she didn't say another word. Aegon gestured angrily, and his men took her away.
That was unworthy of you,
a woman said. Aegon turned and saw Elene Cromwell, the Jadwin's maidservant, who'd been found beaten up and unconscious in her room. She was curvaceous, pretty, except for the scars and bruises on her face, but Lady Jadwin fancied herself an artist, so she liked to surround herself with pretty things.
Yes, Aegon said. I suppose it was. But seeing what she's done, what a waste.
My mistress has made many poor choices, Elene said. She's hurt many people, destroyed marriages. But she isn't a murderer, Lord General. My lord, I know what happened here last night.
Really? So you're the one?
His voice was more cutting than he intended. He was still trying to put the pieces together himself. How had that guard, Stumpy, who now resembled his nickname more than ever, been killed? Why would the Duchess kill the prince silently and change her clothes but not finish washing her hands and face before screaming for help?
Surely if she'd been cold-blooded enough to murder the prince, maybe in a cold rage as he left her, and been self-possessed enough to start hiding the evidence, she would have done a better job of it before calling people to her. But then, some of the guests had claimed it was a man's voice they had heard yell upstairs. The guard? Had he stumbled upon the murder, yelled wordlessly, and then been beheaded? Beheading someone wasn't easy, Aegon knew that. Even if you cut between the vertebra, it took substantial strength. Aegon had examined Stumpy, and the blade had cut through the vertebra. He turned his eyes back to Elene.
Sorry, he said. This has been a difficult night. Any way you can help would be welcome.
She looked up, and there were tears in her eyes.
I know who killed the prince. He's a wet boy, masquerading as a lord. I knew what he was, and I knew that he was coming, but I didn't think he'd hurt anybody. His name is Kylar. Kylar Stern.
What? Aegon said.
It's true. I swear it.
Look, young lady, your loyalty to your mistress is admirable, but you don't need to do this. If you hold to that story, you'll go to jail, at the least. If you're found to be an accomplice or even an unwitting accessory to the murder of the prince, you may be hanged. Are you sure you want to do that, just to save Trudana Jadwin?
It isn't for her.
Tears coursed down her cheeks.
Then it's for this Kylar Stern. He was the young man who had the fight with Logan Gyre. You must hate him fiercely.
She just looked away. In the rising sunlight, the tears on her cheeks glowed like jewels.
No, sir. Not at all.
Lord General, a soldier said quietly from the doorway. He looked shaken.
I just came from the Gyre estate, sir. It's chaos there. There are hundreds of people going through the house, wailing, sir. They're dead, sir.
Get a hold of yourself. What do you mean, dead? You mean murdered?
More like butchered, sir.
Who's been murdered, soldier?
Sir.
All of them. Chapter 43. The king fidgeted in his throne. It was a vast piece of ivory and horn, inlaid with gold tracery, and it made him look a boy. The audience chamber was empty today, except for the regular guards, several guards hidden in the room's secret exits, and Durzo Blint. The emptiness made the chamber seem cavernous. Banners and tapestries adorned the walls, but did nothing to stave off the perpetual chill of such a large stone room. Seven pairs of pillars held the high ceiling, and two sets of seven steps each led to the throne.
Durzo stood quietly, waiting for the king to initiate the conversation. He already had a battle plan if it came to that. It was second nature to him. The Meister standing by the king would die first, then the two guards flanking the throne, then the king himself. With his talent, he could probably jump from the throne up to the passage above it, currently obscured by a banner. He'd kill the archer within, and from there, he'd be uncatchable. Like all battle plans, it would last only until the first move, but it was always useful to have a general plan, especially when you had no idea what your enemies knew. Durzo felt himself reaching into his garlic pouch, but he forced his hand to be still. Now was no time to show nerves. It was harder to stop his hand than he would have guessed. Something about the bite of garlic was comforting when he was stressed.
"You let my boy die?"
the king said, rising.
"They killed my boy last night, and you did nothing!"
"I'm not a bodyguard."
The king grabbed a spear from the guard standing beside him and threw it. Durzo was surprised at how good a throw it was. Had he stood still, the spear would have caught him in the sternum. But of course he didn't stand still. He swayed to the side, not even moving his feet, with careless, and he hoped infuriating, ease. The spear bounced off the floor and then hissed as wood and steel slid across stone. There was a rattle of armor and the whisper of arrows being drawn back all around the room. But the guards didn't attack.
"You're not shit unless I say so,"
the king said. He strode forward, coming down his double flight of seven steps to stand in front of Durzo. Tactically, a poor move. He was now blocking at least three of the archer's shots.
"You're shit, you shitting, shitting shit!"
"Your Majesty," Durzo said gravely. "A man of your stature's cursing vocabulary ought to extend beyond a tedious reiteration of the excreta that fills the void between the ears."
The king looked momentarily confused. The guards looked at each other, aghast. The king saw the look and realized from their expressions that he'd been insulted. He backhanded Durzo, and Durzo let the blow fall. Any quick motion now, and a nervous archer might loose his arrow. The king wore rings on all of his fingers, and two of them carved furrows in Durzo's cheek. Durzo clenched his jaw to quell the rising black fury. He breathed once. Twice. He said,
"The only reason you're alive right now isn't that I'm not willing to trade my life for yours, Aline. I'd hate to be killed by amateurs. But know this. If you ever lay a hand on me again, you'll be dead less than a second later. Your Majesty."
King Aline Gunder the Ninth lifted his hand, seriously contemplating becoming the late King Aline Gunder the Ninth. He lowered his hand, but a triumphant gleam filled his eyes.
"I won't have you killed yet, Durzo. I won't have you killed because I have something better than death for you. You see, I know about you, Durzo Blint. I know. You have a secret, and I know it."
"Forgive my quaking."
"You have an apprentice, a young man, styling himself as a noble, Kyle something or other. A young man staying with those holier-than-thou drakes. Quite a student of the sword, isn't he, Master Tully?"
A chill shot down Durzo's spine. Night angels have mercy. They knew. It was bad. Worse than bad. If they knew Kylar was his apprentice, it couldn't be long before they pinned the prince's death on him. Especially with the spectacle Kylar